This week, gold stocks stole the spotlight. One of the few rays of sunlight in a stormy week on Wall Street. Hello, everyone. Great to be back with you on this weekend. Your host, Chris Waltzek. We've got another big show with two must-hear interviews lined up. James Turk of Gold Money returns to the show with less than sanguine comments on the domestic economy. Although it's been a tough market over the last 3 years, since 2000, gold has still appreciated on average 11% each year and held its purchasing power better than almost every competing asset class. For instance, the U.S. dollar's lower, stocks and bonds have hardly budged, but gold's up at least fourfold from $250 to $1,000. Next, economist John Williams of Shadow Stats kicks a 50-yard field goal. His work indicates that the economy never recovered from 2008, and he says a U.S. dollar endgame will lead to unbelievably high gold prices. And Robert Ian takes the week off, returning to the show next week with his latest report. We'd like for you all to call into our toll-free hotline. That's 1-206-6665-370. Just jot it down on a post-it pad, please, or plug it right into your phone and 1-206-6665-370. Gold Seek begins now with the market weather recap. Well, heavy weather appeared over the New York COMEX exchange this week amid hawkish comments from Fed governors. Nevertheless, gold held steady near the break-even point off just $7 at $10.81 an ounce. Silver gave back 50 cents, about 3.5%, finishing at $14.20, while the XEU Gold and Silver Equities Index was off 1%, but most of its components fared quite well. West Texas Intermediate crude lost about $3.50, 8.5%, finishing at $44.30 per barrel. Well, the top story moving the markets continues to involve rate hike speculation. New York Fed President William Dudley noted that the Fed's interest rate rocket could lift off soon, and there's currently a 70% chance of a move in December, according to the Fed Funds Futures data at the CME Group. Even if Fed policymakers fail to light the fuse, rate hikes are a near certainty next year as viewed by the same contracts. I'm currently calling for at least 1.5% to 2% before the end of 2016. Nevertheless, central banks around the globe aren't drinking the Fed's Kool-Aid. Gold purchases soared to the second highest level amid soaring purchases of the yellow metal by officials in China and Russia, which continue to divest their foreign assets and reserves in favor of the metals. The PBOC holds trillions of U.S. dollar-denominated treasuries, which value is inversely related to our interest rates. Put simply, China knows that rates are moving higher, and they're positioning themselves away from U.S. debt. I think it'd be worthwhile to set up a hedge fund that does little more than shadows the PBOC's moves. Net purchases were 175 tons, approaching the record 180 tons, according to the World Gold Council this week. Barclays also expects central banks to continue increasing their stockpiles. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, gold stocks held up really well this week. Investors directed their profits from flagging U.S. shares into top gold companies like Newmont Mines and Goldcorp, as one of our favorites, Seabridge Gold, which rocketed higher, and Fortuna Gold, FSM. I expect solid buying opportunities in the coming weeks. Well, moving on to the Wall Street Report, heavy clouds appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors braced for higher interest rates for the first time in years. The Dow ended the week at 17,246, down nearly 700 points, about 4% for the week, while the S&P 500 ended at 2023, off 76, down 4.25, and the NASDAQ shed 219 points, off 2%, finishing at 49.27. Elsewhere, inflation fell sharply this week as seen by U.S. wholesale prices for October. Investors prefer to see slightly higher prices, a strong indication of a robust economy. On Friday, the Labor Department announced the U.S. Producer Price Index fell for the second month running, while retail purchases also fell abruptly, not the type of typical behavior one would expect in a strong economy ahead of the big holiday season. Despite sluggish inflation figures, Fed governors seem nearly universally hawkish. On Thursday, Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Stanley Fischer and New York Fed President Dudley also suggested a December rate hike, while St. Louis Fed President James Bullard and Richmond Fed President Lacker noted policymakers' intentions to increase rates at perhaps a faster pace than expected. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the seven-component sentiment index fell back into the neutral zone following last week's signs of greed. The market pause came to pass just as expected last week, thanks in no small part to the concerted efforts of four big Fed leaders to knock the market down. Now it's time to wait and see if support holds and a consolidation builds. Otherwise, another 2008-2009-like market scenario becomes more likely. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with James Turk and John Williams. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com, author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It, as well as a follow-up text. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thanks, Chris. It's always great to speak with you.
Well, it's great to have you back. And I wonder if we could begin the dialogue today with comments you've made earlier in the year regarding the erosion of the middle class that has long been touted as the backbone of capitalism, the hallmark of a robust economy, the envy, if you will, of the world. But, you know, in recent decades, the destruction of our currencies around the globe seems to be also impacting the affluence, as seen by some startling statistics. Currently, over half of individuals 25 or under in the U.S. are living in their parents' homes. 1 million American school children are living in their parents' cars or in shelters. Add to the mix that nearly 50 million folks are on food stamps. At least half of American homes receive some sort of federal support. These might have been, I think, classified as statistics from a third world country a few decades ago. How does it tie in with our currency woes?
Yeah, those are really shocking statistics, aren't they? You know, it really comes down to, you know, financial repression. When you have zero interest rates or near zero interest rates, you know, how is someone supposed to save, you know, for the future? You know, for a kid's college education, you know, or to buy a consumer good, or, you know, to save up to put a down payment on a house. You mentioned the 25-year-olds. It's really the millennials, young adults that today range from about 18 to 34 years of age. They're having an extremely difficult time simply because the purchasing power of money is being eroded. They can't save or accumulate enough capital. So what they're doing is they're falling back onto family support in order to try to accumulate some capital to get that head start, to buy a house or to build up a savings account. It's just very, very difficult these days.
It is. And, you know, how can the middle class compete with central bank money printing? It erodes the purchasing power. And this is, you know, I think just exacerbated by the globalization that we've run into and offshoring of tens of millions of high quality jobs. Over 500,000 high-paying industrial-related jobs have left the United States over the course of the last 15 years, approaching 7 to 8 million. If it were 7 or 8,000, it would be bad enough, but 7 or 8 million sounds like an orchestrated evisceration of the working and middle classes.
Yeah, absolutely. It sure does seem that way. And it's also happening, you know, with zero interest rates. You know, it really is the key. You made the point about the middle class being the backbone of a capitalist society. You know, they are the group that saves. They are the group that produces. So they are important in a capitalist society. And we want to live in a capitalist society for the reason that the production of goods and services increase everyone's standards of living. And, in fact, that's not happening now. That's why we have such dissatisfaction, not just in the United States, but pretty much across the globe. And the problem is that central banks are in there trying to manipulate this and intervene here and intervene there in order to save the banking system. But, you know, the banking system's got some severe problems, and, you know, they're not going to be dealt with by negative interest rates or zero interest rates. But, you know, the central banks keep experimenting with these policies and refuse to look at what's actually happening in the real world.
And if we look at history, even serfs were allowed to keep roughly 50% of their output. We typically don't look back on serfdom and think of this as a time of affluence for the typical individual or small family. I mean, we're giving away, when you include the inflation-adjusted figures, much more. So, I mean, at some point, that system is going to have some trouble. You've talked about in the past about, you know, alternatives to currency. And, of course, the yellow metal immediately and silver come to mind. And you've also brought up this theme of the persistence of price backwardation that really, up until the last few years, we've never seen such stubborn backwardation because it presents an arbitrage opportunity. Why don't you give people an overview of this and what it could mean for investors on a forward basis?
Yeah, exactly. You know, what it is the spot price for gold or the spot price for silver is trading above the futures price. So I'm just looking at my screen now. I can buy a gold spot today at 70 cents above of December delivery. Now, it shouldn't happen that way, because if you have physical gold, you would sell it and buy it back in the future. What you do is you're buying it back at a lower price. You save the storage charge over the next few weeks. And you have the use of that money in the meantime to generate some kind of income from it. The fact that it's not happening, it just shows one of the major anomalies in the market. In theory, backwardation in gold should not happen, but it is happening. And again, it's a result of financial repression. But that doesn't detract from the attractiveness of gold or silver, for that matter. You know, they are money outside the banking system. And, you know, while it's down a few percent in dollar terms this year, gold, and particularly pretty much across the board, is up some of the, most of the world's major currencies. And in countries which are having severe currency problems, like Brazil and Argentina, you know, gold is doing beautifully, which is what it's supposed to do. It's a safe haven, no counterparty risk. You know, it's not based on someone's promise. It's based on the fact that it's a tangible asset with 5,000 years of history.
Has stood the test of time, certainly has held up even today. I mean, it's easy to forget that back around the year 2000, where that dot-com frenzy took off, and you could argue there's a echo dot-com frenzy occurring today. Since then, $250 an ounce, juxtapose that against 1,000 plus today. I mean, that's a remarkable return in just over 10, 15 years. So it's certainly holding up its purchasing power relative to the U.S. dollar, the pound sterling, almost any currency across the board. It's doing its job.
That's exactly right. You know, on an average annual basis, the appreciation since the turn of the century for gold is double digits, 11 to 12% against all of the major currencies of the world, some a little bit higher, some a little bit lower. But, you know, that's far superior to what you get in a savings account. And the other thing is that what you need to do is you need to calculate prices of gold, goods and services in terms of gold, in terms of ounces or grams of gold. You know, we calculate in terms of dollars, and we think the gold price is going up and down. But the reality is it's the price of the dollar that's going up and down. And the reason why I say this is an ounce of gold today purchases the same amount of crude oil it did 15 years ago, same amount of crude oil it did, you know, back in 1950. You know, over long periods of time, gold preserves purchasing power, which is why it has this 5,000-year history as money.
Well, I like to use the example of a family member who I convinced 10 years ago to buy some silver when it dipped down to $6, and they now have a huge pile of silver that's worth threefold what was paid for it. Now, what's interesting is their portfolio in stocks and bonds has remained unchanged, and all I hear about is how amazing the return has been on those stocks and bonds, which was the bulk of their investment, which is up almost exactly 50%. The silver capital appreciation more than double. You could, let's say, 250 to 300%. So you're talking a factor of 5 to 6 fold on investments that were made at the same time across the asset classes. They'd be happy to come on the show to verify this. What seemed like a silly investment at the time that wouldn't offer any dividends or coupons turned out to be a wonderful investment against the erosion of that insidious inflation. Leads me to an another topic. You've been one of these who's not afraid to share lofty targets. We rarely cover those anymore because we're in the middle of a bear market. But, you know, some of us always like to hear the potential energy, if you will, on an astronomical climb in silver and gold. Are you sticking with some of your higher targets?
Unless something has fundamentally changed and gold is no longer money, which is sort of ridiculous considering the fact that it still preserves purchasing power the same way it did, you know, centuries ago. Yes, you know, gold is very, very undervalued relative to paper currency. And even on a short-term basis, you know, gold is extremely undervalued. So, you know, I've been looking for a rally here in the autumn. Last year, we had a rally, and then it died out, and you know we ended the year down a couple percent in dollar terms, but up against most of the other world's major currencies. And it looks like it's going to be a similar result this year. I thought maybe we would close the year around 1,300, which would be a 9 or 10% increase in the price of gold over the year. But in dollar terms, it's not going to happen based on what we see so far, unless something unusual happens over the next several weeks. But, you know, gold looks like it's going to close the year higher in terms of most of the other world's major currencies. What we're seeing is a run out of the problem currencies, or the currencies with the obvious problems like the yen and the euro, and into gold. It's a knee-jerk emotion reaction rather than a rational decision.
Speaking of these almost emotional investment decisions, you know, this idea that one can run to the U.S. dollar, that one can run to the United States as the de facto safe haven, that I think is losing its appeal. And as folks start to recognize that there are alternatives, I mean, just look at the yuan, and the People's Bank of China are making a big push with the IMF to establish the yuan as a reserve currency. That's direct competition. That's head-to-head competition with the U.S. dollar. And they have a fantastic case. Really appreciate your thoughts on the threat of debt implosion. You know, I bring this up with almost all my guests, and there seems to be a consensus convinced that the threat of debt implosion, i.e. these toxic derivatives, CDSs, mortgage-backed securities, and related instruments of financial mass destruction, could be what's capping the inflation theme, at least in the near term. And that's what is keeping up central bankers, the ECB, talking about negative rates and even deeper into negative territory for the first time in history. Do you think that their case for this debt implosion, i.e. deflation, will eventually be offset by all the monetary expansion?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. What's happening is that there's too much debt in the world. And in order to try to keep this system going, particularly at the government level, the central banks have brought rates down to zero or negative. So what they're doing is they're putting the burden of that debt repayment on people who would ordinarily be saving money. And what they're effectively doing is depreciating the currency in order to make that debt burden less than it would be if we were in an economy where interest rates were at, you know, normal levels. But the point is, Chris, is that, you know, at the end of the day, these debts have to be repaid. And they're either going to be repaid by the people who borrowed them, or they're going to be repaid, in effect, by the people who loaned the money, because they're not going to get their money back. You know, these debts are going to have to disappear before we can actually create a new base on which to build a sound economic, growth, you know, going forward. And unfortunately, central banks don't, you know, recognize that. They're trying to keep the bloated welfare states of governments around the world afloat. And it's just not going to, it's not possible to do that.
What about the writing off of bad debt? You know, I mean, what if this theme were to catch some momentum? Because I think that a lot of investors I talk to, and even market watchers, and who have done remarkably well in recent years, have changed their mindset to include, well, inflation will be a big problem maybe 5 or 10 years down the road, but until we have washed all of the bad debt out of the system, I'm not going to worry about it.
Yeah, no, I don't see it that way. You know, the other word for inflation is loss of purchasing power of the currency. We're losing purchasing power in the currency, but it's not inflation in the sense that, you know, that we've seen back in the 1970s. But it's still loss of purchasing power of the currency. The currency is being debased. So, you know, they're trying to deal with these debts, but I don't think they're going to be able to deal with them because the system is unsustainable. There's not enough wealth being created in the world to sustain all of the debts that are being carried around the world, let alone all of the derivatives we have on top of the debts.
In the end game, when Fed officials are faced with fiscal destruction, budget that cannot be sustained, and of course, dollar, which loses, you know, maybe 50% of its value in a matter of days or weeks, when we start to see signs like this, will they have any tool left in their toolbox or any weapon left in their arsenal to address that situation?
Yeah, if the gold is still there in Fort Knox, that's going to be their tool. But keep in mind, Chris, when you talk about the dollar, there are actually two types of dollars. There's the constitutional dollar, which is based on gold and silver, and then there's the Federal Reserve dollar, which is based on the Federal Reserve. You know, the Federal Reserve dollar is essentially a liability of the Federal Reserve, which is its own legal entity. You know, the end game may be that because the Federal Reserve owns so much U.S. government debt anyway, it just lets the Federal Reserve go bankrupt. And all of the Federal Reserve dollars disappear with it, as does the government debt. And then the U.S. government uses the gold in Fort Knox, assuming that gold is still there, to go back to some kind of constitutional monetary system. There's so many different possibilities. You can't predict how it's going to happen, but you have to look at the legal structure of the system to try to make some guesses to what may or may not happen.
Any other comments as we wrap up here? Anything you're watching in the markets that we haven't covered today?
The stock market's looking a little bit toppy, but you know, if the Federal Reserve and the other central banks are going to continue to print through various quantitative easing programs, and you know, Europe is going, you know, full steam ahead in terms of that, it's ultimately going to pump up stock prices around the world. And eventually we're going to see this turn in gold, and it's going to come, and it'll be quick, because gold is so undervalued. When it finally turns, everybody's going to be jumping on the board, but it's going to be tough to chase this train, because when it leaves the station, it's going to leave quickly.
I think so, and I think, fortunately, though, the train, you know, the engineer will be on lunch break until the Fed officials finish at least a point and a half rate hike on the overnight lending rate by the end of 2016. And I think that really sets the floor at that point for the precious metals and just the buying opportunity of a lifetime. But, of course, markets are not that easy to predict. So why not dollar cost average until then and be pleasantly surprised?
That's really the safe strategy, and that's something I've always promoted through Gold Money and also now through BitGold, which has become part of Gold Money. BitGold.com is part of Gold Money, and it's a way to accumulate gold cost-effectively on a dollar-cost averaging basis.
Well, James Turk, any other parting information for our listeners? Maybe you'd like to tell them more about Gold Money.
Yeah, no, you can find us at goldmoney.com or bitgold.com. And Gold Money Incorporated is a Toronto Stock Exchange venture-listed company, trading symbol XAU on the TSXV. Thank you, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome John Williams, head of Shadow Stats, an alternative economic resource, a must bookmark website.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Thanks for joining us. And recently, a top story driving the markets, clearly news from the Federal Reserve and their latest meeting minutes from the FOMC meeting, look as though they still might raise rates this year. The Fed Funds futures at the CME Group are indicating about 70% odds, actually 71% yesterday, today about 68% odds of a quarter point rate hike this December at the upcoming FOMC meeting.
What exactly is happening with the Fed is a good question. I don't think they're going to, but I don't think they're going to change policy and raise rates. But let me give you a little bit of background here. The all the talk, and the Fed has encouraged this, the Fed has set it up, has been tied to the economy in some form of economic improvement. If they're waiting for a solid economic recovery in the underlying data, it's going to be a real long time before they raise interest rates. Being tied to the economy here really is nonsense, because the Fed knows there's very little they can do to help the economy. Bernanke used to talk about that all the time, that there's very little the Fed could do. What's happened here is really quite frightening in terms of its implications and potential. We had the system, and I'm talking the financial system, the banking system, on the brink of collapse back in 2008. That's when all sorts of extraordinary things were done, because the banking system technically was insolvent. People recognized it. People were from around the world were trying to get their money out of the dollar to get their cash out of the U.S. banking system. The Fed, the Treasury, did everything they had to do to prevent the system from collapsing. Now, keep in mind, I mean, the Fed talks about its mandate from Congress to keep unemployment low and to keep inflation in a happy, contained range. And while that is indeed a mandate they have, their primary function in life is to keep the banking system solvent. They weren't doing it back in 2008. The system was on the brink of collapse. The actions that you saw at that time ranged from extraordinary creation of money, bailouts, extended guarantees. They lent money to whoever needed it. The Fed ended up buying AIG, which is the largest insurance company in the world at the time. General Motors went under. They got bailed out. Number of banks were bailed out. They did everything they had to do, irrespective of cost or future implications to the system, to keep the banking system from collapsing. They just could not have that happen. The problem was, well, everything that they did to keep the system afloat, and the system did stay afloat, was stopgap. They didn't do anything fundamentally to address the issues that had led to the crisis. The economy still is in trouble. I'll contend, I'm sure we'll be getting into that. The banks are far from being in good shape. The federal government still is involved in the deficit spending with the gap-based, meaning generally accepted accounting principles, accounting on the deficit, showing roughly a $5 trillion per year shortfall, overall $100 trillion, something that never can be paid off, or the obligations can never be met by the U.S. government. The circumstance there that either down the road you're going to have a hyperinflation as everything, as all that those obligations and debts are monetized, or they have to go through very serious restructuring of the programs such as Social Security and Medicare and make them solvent over the long term. None of those issues were addressed then. None of the issues have been addressed now. They did do some things to try and get the banks in a little better shape. The big thing that the Fed did after the initial stopgap measures was its quantitative easing. And what it did there was it bought trillions of dollars worth of treasuries, largely held by the banking system. So the banks had cash. The banks then put the cash with the Federal Reserve as excess reserves, where the Fed paid them interest on that money, risk-free interest. The problem was that if the Fed were really trying to help the economy, they would have encouraged the banks to lend that money into the regular flow of commerce, would have increased lending, would have helped businesses, would have helped individuals. I know people with top credit scores who have difficulty borrowing money. Still, it's the banking system is not right. The quantitative easing circumstance was really very little more than a covert bailout, further bailout of the banking system. In the process, the economy continued to falter. It wasn't recovering. My goodness, if you look at the grand scale picture of the GDP as it's reported, official picture is that the economy turned down right at the end of 2007, crashed into the middle of 2009, and then recovered. I'll contend that the economy started turning down in 2005, 2006. You saw it in the housing construction sector. Indeed, it tumbled through 2008 and 2009, and the middle of 2009 appears to have been where the economy hit bottom. But we didn't rebound. What I'll contend is that we at that point entered a period of low level stagnation, and there's a lot of evidence to support that. And now this is 8 years after the official downturn started, we're beginning to turn down again, and that's being clearly shown enough so that we're going to be getting headline negative GDP numbers not too far down the road, and you're going to have recognition of a new recession. I'll contend that what we've been seeing here really is just an ongoing process of the economic crash that we had that started back in the 2005 to 2007 period. So in terms of having happy numbers ahead that the Fed can say, oh, yes, now we can raise interest rates, that's nonsense. They're not coming. But again, they were never trying to stimulate the economy. They're trying to save the banking system. They knew that the public politically didn't want to see a bailout of the banks. So what they did very simply was they used the ongoing weakness in the economy as political cover for expanding and then continuing the quantitative easing. Quantitative easing continues. They've stopped purchasing treasuries. But they're still holding all the treasuries that they bought in at that period of time. In effect, during the I think it was fiscal 2014, effectively they monetized 75% of the effective net new issuance of treasury debt for public consumption, the debt to be held by the public. That, I think, is a very important factor there, which I'll get back to in a minute. I'm sorry, I know I'm getting around and around here a little bit, but I'm about to come to the point with it, and that is that I don't think we ever recovered. In fact, I know we never recovered from the panic of 2008. That's the Fed's problem. They're seeing something there that's really, really scared them. They can raise the rates anytime they want. They supposedly, sure thing, they're going to, you know, up the 70% and 80% range. They were going to raise rates at one point in September. Didn't happen. Then, they're going to happen in October. Didn't happen. And as soon as they didn't raise rates in October, then all the talking begins. Well, it's definitely going to be December, that's set, guaranteed. Why? I mean, what's going on here? This is the Federal Reserve should be able to make a decision, number one, and it can raise rates anytime it wants. Number two, they're not holding back because of the economy. And I know that for a fact. They know they can't do anything with the economy. In fact, raising interest rates might actually help the economy a little bit. I know that sounds a little counter to conventional wisdom, because that means maybe mortgage rates will be going higher, that'll hit the housing industry. So there's an element of truth in that. On the other hand, banks should be operating with greater profit margins on their with their interest rates in lending, enabling them to make loans to less creditworthy people as they used to. They price the risk into their what they charge in interest and such. But that would expand the lending, it would expand the people's liquidity, and it would actually have some expansive effect on the economy, not long term. And there are all sorts of things as to why the economy remains in at terrible trouble at this point. But I think the reason the Fed is holding back is that they don't know what to do. With the collapse in 2008 was they bought some time, they pushed things into the future, and were exactly where they were when they got to the extremes of their intervention. They're afraid to pull it back. They don't know what's going to happen. They see continued and probably mounting liquidity concerns again in the banking system. They see it globally. I think they're just going to sit on their hands come December, as they have continued to do so, meeting after meeting. And if they don't get it, if they don't raise rates in December, I don't think you're going to see any rate action until after the presidential election. Traditionally, it gets very awkward for the Fed to make moves in an election year, very briefly, or maybe not so briefly, is why I think they're not going to do it. If they do raise rates, they're going to raise a quarter point. I'm not quite sure how bad the effects of that are going to be. They don't know. And that's what has them scared. They're seeing something there that really frightens them. They don't want to trigger something. I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's enough to make grown men that normally, and women who would normally be able to make a meaningful decision here, waffle and tremble and play all sorts of games with the public and the stock market. It is not a happy circumstance. It does not have a happy ending. Again, they did nothing to resolve the issues that are plaguing the system. And as this happens, keep in mind, I'll tell you why I think they keep harping on raising rates, is they're using that as a tool to try and keep the dollar strong. Factors, traditional factors, the way a central bank would respond to move its currency. Interest rate policy is a big factor. So if you raise rates and the markets think you're going to raise rates, your currency tends to be relatively stronger. As soon as they said they weren't raising rates, the dollar started coming under some pressure. So all of a sudden, yes, we're going to raise it next time round, absolutely, and the dollar starts strengthening again. Then they intervene in the markets to reinforce that. They intervene to knock down gold prices and open manipulation in the futures markets to knock down the price of gold. Enough so. It's obvious somebody's doing this. You have regulators that supposedly prevent things like that from happening. If it weren't a central bank, you'd have regulators investigating to see who was doing this. Nobody's looking into it. This is central bank orchestrated. They're trying to scare people away from gold because they know gold is where people are going to end up as the system eventually falls apart and the dollar falls apart. And I'm still looking for that to happen.
You may have also read recently that the People's Bank of China is making a powerful coordinated effort to promote the yuan as an alternative reserve currency. For instance, they just have linked or pegged the yuan to the Swiss franc, and they are in discussions with the IMF regarding the potential reserve status of their currency. By holding gold down, would that not help the Fed to maintain the status quo?
They're not dumping physical gold. The Treasury gold and that by the head, the Fed presumably is all tracked. The selling here has been in the futures markets. No physical gold, it's paper gold. And people playing with the futures contracts, driving the price down and scaring the markets and getting the private investors to respond accordingly. So it's not I think if I were a central bank and seeing these things unfold, I'd want to be holding as much gold as possible going forward. Because I think when the dollar collapses, and it will collapse, you're going to have some recasting of the global currency system, and I would not be at all surprised to see gold somehow as part of that in order to instill a little confidence in the public as to what's going on.
Moving on to another topic here that seems to be gaining some interest in the precious metals community as well as the investment sector. We've heard recently from several of our top guests and market pundits, financial analysts on this show. The main concern that should be on the minds of most investors, money managers, policymakers is not inflation or hyperinflation, as you've promoted for so long. This show has been an advocate of the threat of much higher prices, galloping inflation. The latest trend, if you will, or theme, is the threat of imploding debt. I mean, we have hundreds of trillions of dollars in notional interest rate sensitive debt instruments around the globe, and we're hearing on a regular basis of financial institutions with huge debt issues. Do you feel that this threat of debt, as they're calling it, or the shadow of a debt implosion is temporary pause on the road to much higher prices?
Well, you had a debt implosion back in the crisis of 2008. That was derivatives structured with the mortgage-backed securities and such were, I think, the proximal trigger of what happened there. The way I hear this taken is that, the debt implosion, you have a deflation. Where people talk about deflation, they're fearing the deflation, or what Bernanke was talking about when he feared deflation, when he made his famous helicopter speech back in, I think it was 2002. It was a 1930s style deflation. The central bank can prevent that from happening, and it's prevented it so far. What happened in the 30s, and this is tied to basic money supply, you had a number of bank failures. And we have what you were facing in 2008 were bank failures, very large institutions. Lehman was one that probably triggered the run on the banks. And that they could have prevented that had they wanted to. So you have to wonder. But back in the 30s, a goodly portion of the banking system went out of business. And when the banks failed, people who had deposits with the banks lost their money. There was no FDIC insurance. So as the banks closed down and people lost their deposits, the money supply collapsed. Money supply was down maybe 30%. You had roughly 30% deflation. The economy contracted in real terms after even a lot where the inflation was down about 30% peak to trough. In response to that, the government in later years instituted FDIC insurance. Now, that's limited, at least in theory. But you look at what happened in 2008, and the federal government, through the Treasury, guaranteed all deposits, everything. Again, they did everything they had to keep the banking system from imploding and to keep the money supply from imploding, and they were successful. We're seeing 5% growth in the broad money supply right now. It did go briefly negative, but during some extreme things, but nothing that would give you a real deflation. Now, when you get to debt, people say, "Aha! Well, you have a debt collapse that triggers deflation." Not necessarily, and generally, it doesn't cause an implosion in the money supply. Let me give you an example. If I borrow $1 million from a bank, that's a little more difficult to do these days than it was before 2008, and that's Fed policy right now. The Fed eases up on that, and I can borrow $1 million. And once I borrow the money, I put it in, I deposit it with my bank. The bank normally would take 10% of that for reserves and lend 90% of my deposit out to other people and the banking system would, so that by the time you finish, $1 million being lent to me creates $10 million worth of money supply as the bank, as it cycles itself through the system and the money gets deposited and the banks take their reserve requirements and then lend out. I'll let that on the balance. The reserve requirements are, I mean, the banks, again, this is a system far from normal, but the banks usually would create money supply with the lending. Now, I go under. I go to my bank, I say, sorry, guys, I made a bad bet shorting gold. Lost all my money. Got to write my loan off. My money's already lost. The $9 million of additional money supply that was created by my loan is still in the system. There's no way the bank can pull that out of the system. It's that what happened is the bank takes the hit. I mean, they try and recover the loan from me, and what they can't recover, they take a hit on their balance sheet. Now, that can impair their lending ability, and this was a problem, probably still is a problem, one reason you're not seeing the type of lending you normally see. So if they're not lending normally, then you have impaired growth in the money supply. It wouldn't be growing as it would normally, but it's not collapsing. The bad debts do not shrink the money supply. And if they don't shrink the money supply, it's not going to give you a deflation the way people have feared it, the 1930s style. The Fed, indeed, can counter that. The Fed encourages the banks to do more in the way of commercial lending or personal lending. They can increase the money supply. You will see pickup in that. You will see higher inflation. But they've been in a period of trying to hold the system together. The risk of a big deflation is negligible. The problem comes here in the area of what's going to happen when the rest of the world decides it doesn't want to hold dollars. Now, we've had that happen a couple of times. The most recent one, and where it almost blew apart, which is post-panic of 2008, was at the time, I think it was 2011, when Standard & Poor's lowered the rating on U.S. Treasuries. At that point in time, they say that, you know, the government never did anything to address the issues that got us into that mess in 2008. They still have not addressed the deficit. They put all this now off until after the election. I don't think the rest of the world's going to sit by with that. When we had the crisis, the rest of the world said, okay, U.S., you do what you need to do to get your house in order, get the dollar solid. We're depending on it, and we'll go along and give you what support you need. That support evaporated in 2011. People began to throw up their hands. Massive intervention, tied the Swiss franc to the euro, all sorts of arm twisting. The dollar was basically propped up, and we sort of muddling along until the middle of 2014. Then you had the Russians taking some actions with Ukraine. What we did was, I'm talking now the United States, was we imposed sanctions against Russian leaders. But also, covertly, we did things to put significant financial stress on Russia. We orchestrated a rally in the dollar and a decline in oil prices. And you can, if you look at the end of, I think it was the end of June, within 3 or 4 days of taking action against certain Russian leaders in terms of penalties, oil prices start collapsing, the dollar starts rallying. That was orchestrated. That was all aimed at trying to financially punish the Russians for their misbehavior in the political military arena. In order to support that, all sorts of things had to be done. It went on its own momentum for a while. Then he started. Then he had to pull back on the quantitative easing, talks raising interest rates. I mean, how long have we been looking at the Fed talking about raising interest rates? I mean, I'm sure it goes. My memory on dates is real bad, but I'm sure it's been more than a year. All tied to trying to give the world some reason for supporting the dollar. Related to that, the economy. If you have a relatively strong economy, that helps your currency. But the I'll contend that the reality, underlying reality here, has been that we have not had a strong economy, continues to falter. So the signs of a weak economy, anything that suggests that the Fed is not going to address its activity and not raise interest rates, or if you see the economy continuing to weaken, which you're going to, that all of a sudden suggestions are that maybe the Fed needs to ease further, or it's going to have to bail out more banks. You're going to have a QE4, QE5. Any of that's going to start pushing the dollar sharply lower again. And that's where you run into the inflation risk. Because with that, you're also going to see a sharp spike in oil prices again. And the inflation that comes out of the commodity end that are driven higher by the weaker dollar, that's going to start the process of the inflation that eventually become a hyperinflation, as I view it. What you'll see, we probably have $11 trillion and more like $17 trillion now that's sitting outside the United States, held in foreign hands. As that's liquidated, the Fed's going to have to absorb that, put the dollar under heavy selling pressure. It's going to put upside pressure on the money supply, upside pressure on inflation. What's happened recently? Well, China's been selling the dollar. They've needed it for internal use. The Japanese are backing away from the dollar. These are people who were major buyers of the dollar. And guess what? Central banks, guess who else was buying the dollar more than anyone else? That was the Federal Reserve, U.S. Federal Reserve. I don't think that was a coincidental benefit for the U.S. Treasury. I think that's very much a part of the way they were working quantitative easing, because they were afraid that the Treasury is going to have liquidity problems and funding its needs. And that may be an issue that's holding them back at this point, because the Congress is moving ahead to not cut back on the budget deficit. You're going to, as the economy weakens, the deficit widens, Treasury funding needs increase, and with the Fed buying the Treasuries, and then it returns the interest that it earns on those Treasuries to the government. It does help the government as long as the markets are accepting the fact that the Fed's doing this. But that is monetization of the debt. They can get out of control very easily. I think you're going to have treasury funding problems not too far down the road. The Fed's going to have to come in and become the buyer of last resort as it was year or two ago. And as that happens, that'll be the death knell for the dollar. Global markets will, again, you're already beginning to see some major dollar holders beginning to run for the door. And that should be enough to start the process. I think we're very close seeing the dollar turn sharply lower.
But, you know, when we look at the technicals, at least, the U.S. dollar is remarkably strong. Every time that speculators have tried to knock the greenback down, it comes back with a vengeance, as we saw over the course of the last 3 weeks. And there seems to be an important fundamental factor at play here. We just heard this week from Mario Draghi, as well as others from the ECB and finance ministers, that they are keeping the euro not only one of its benchmark rates there, negative, but they're very seriously considering lowering that rate even further into negative territory.
These guys don't know what to do. And Draghi talks and talks and talks and says what he needs to try and help the markets along. When you see the strength in the dollar here, I mean, the people who are manipulating the situation know what makes technicals look good and bad. This is the technicals. I mean, the technicals are very useful. The various patterns and measures that you can look at that it tells you, you know, how underlying sentiment's moving. Very useful in a free and open market. But we're seeing something here that's rigged. I mean, the dollar strength, again, you came out of the October FOMC meeting, they didn't raise rates. Some rally in the gold, you see some weakness in the dollar. And within a day or two, absolute certainty rates are going to go higher. And the dollar rallies, and gold gets intervened with, and there's some fundamental selling of gold as well by people who are scared, but those are very, very heavily orchestrated markets. I don't believe anything that we're seeing there is underlying fundamentals. Very carefully orchestrated. You've seen these things happen over time, and usually when there's intervention like this, it doesn't last because there are enough people out there that have a sense of what's going on, and they're going to get out of there. Watch the other central banks and their movements. When the pressure mounts significantly there to flee from the dollar, there's not much they're going to be able to do to stop it.
If we really look at the CME Group's numbers, I mean, there are huge speculative trades being made by people, financial institutions, hedge funds, that indicates that over the course of 2016, odds greatly favor by not much later than summer of next year that we're going to see 1.25%, even 1.5% on the benchmark overnight lending rate at the Federal Reserve.
That may happen. But if you do, you're going to see rates rising elsewhere in the world. The U.S. is not alone here.
But don't you feel they're following the lead of the two-year Treasury yield?
The yields are very carefully orchestrated by the central bank. I mean, the central bank owns $2-plus trillion worth of Treasuries. They can do anything they want to with those rates, and they do. This is not a real situation. What will become real, and what is probably becoming real, is major central banks such as China, Japan, Korea, moving out of the U.S. dollar, and someone having to buy up their treasuries. It's not a stable, healthy, normal market, and I wouldn't make any big bets in terms of your standard financial instruments. Let me put it this way. The longer you go out on the yield curve, the more sensitive an instrument is to interest rates in terms of its pricing. You jack up interest rates, you're knocking down the market value of the longer-term treasuries. Who would want to buy a long-term treasury now where you know interest rates are going to go higher over time? And interest rates are going to go higher. I don't know when they're going to do so, but the reason we're not getting it now, the reason we didn't get it a year ago, is that the Fed is not seeing a stable circumstance, and they're very afraid of something happening. So I think that's going to hold them back. The markets may be speculating that they're going to do certain things. Maybe they will. At some point, interest rates will go higher. The markets will take them there as inflation begins to pick up. This is not anything close to a normal, open, free market.
Do you agree with the findings of Barsky and Summers? It's really negative real, not nominal, but real interest rates that tends to underpin explosive growth in precious metals markets. The spread between actual prices and the true inflation-adjusted prices that people pay, that is an excellent indicator of the likelihood that we'll see bull market in the yellow metal.
The yellow metal is generally a pretty good predictor of inflation, a pretty good measure of inflation, But right now, the yellow metal's being heavily manipulated. We have negative interest rates now. As you know, I contend that the if you consider inflation personally, what are you looking at? What do you want to know what the rate of inflation is? What do you want to know that? Well, for most people, in investment or income related, you want to make sure that your income is rising faster than inflation, or at least you're staying even with it, so you're not falling behind. And with your investments, the same thing. You want to stay ahead of inflation. Well, if you believe in the government's numbers, you're losing out. And the government's numbers are locked into the Treasury markets with the TIPS, which is based on the CPI. Starting back in the 80s, I know we've discussed this before, very simply, the government started to manipulate the reporting methodologies on the consumer price index so as to reduce the reported inflation rate. They weren't concerned at all about giving people an accurate number on inflation that measured, the way I put it, is looking at maintaining a constant standard of living and reflecting out-of-pocket expenses. They moved away from that, changing the way that certain goods were weighted. They had computer models to say, oh, this is, you know, because we've had quality improvements here that you can't measure from a monetary standpoint, really the price should be lower, and they adjust lower. And a real simple example, although they have since backed off this particular area, but it's just typical of what's here. It's very easy to see and understand. Some years back, the federal government raised forced the price of gasoline higher by mandating certain additives that would help with the emissions. And when it went into effect, it boosted the cost of a gallon of gasoline by 10 cents, which at the time was a rather large percentage. Now, that was that didn't get into the CPI. Reason being is it was deemed to be a quality improvement. And that was fine. That's the way the government wanted to define it, and what we're talking about here is definition. But from the standpoint of the guy that was pumping his pumping gas into his car, had to go to work, he was mourning and groaning that the cost of filling his car with gasoline had gone up. He wasn't looking at a better air quality down the road. So right there you saw a dichotomy between what the consumer thought inflation was, what he would want to have in his income to help compensate for rising prices, versus what the government says inflation is with a nebulous quality change, where later they introduced various ways of trying to reflect substitution in the CPI. The CPI is still not a full substitution-based index. They're trying to do that, but the idea was, and this is, and if you go back to Alan Greenspan in the early 90s, he'd say, oh, you know, realistic CPI that didn't overstate inflation so much, this would be much better for the government because it would help us with a budget deficit. We wouldn't have to pay so much in cost of living adjustments on Social Security, and it would also help to boost people into higher tax brackets that they're getting false benefit on now because the underlying inflation rate's too high. Well, you'd ask Greenspan what he meant that the CPI was overstated, and he'd say, well, you consider that the price of steak goes up sharply and becomes very expensive, and people buy more hamburger relative to steak. Then their cost of living is less, but that's not reflected in the CPI. And he was correct. It wasn't reflected in the CPI, and it shouldn't have been reflected in the CPI because that's maintaining a constant standard of living. I like steak. I'd like to be able to buy steak. So I'm looking at My market basket of goods, including a fixed weighting of steak, not shifting it to hamburger because steak gets more expensive. So what the government did, backed away from what was a meaningful number for consumers, but one that was most beneficial to the federal government from a financial standpoint. And minimally, you're looking at 3.5 percentage points differential right now. If you do all the methodology changes since 1980, it's up around 7%. But you're already, right now the headline year-to-year inflation is zero. But let's say you use the 3.5%. You're basically, you're seeing negative interest rates. In reality, as the consumer would experience it, as he would look at it as an investment tool to protect his assets and his income.
I wonder if we might address just how the next leg of a potential bull market in the precious metals sector could unfold, or at least a primary uptrend in the CRB and related commodities indices. Can you give us an idea of whether or not our officials can manage their way around such an event here, or are their options becoming somewhat limited?
I think they're up against a wall and they don't know what to do. I mean, they never resolved 2008, and I think they're stymied, and they're very afraid of what's going to happen next. You're beginning to see some movement out of the dollar. You're beginning to see central banks moving away from the dollar. People say, "Oh, yeah, but where are they going to put their money?" Well, guess what? I'd put it in the euro at this point, or the Swiss franc. Oh, but there's not enough liquidity there. Of course there is. You create the liquidity. When the currency moves into the system, it creates its own liquidity. The dollar drops in value. The other currency goes up in value. The system balances out. The rest of the world is in much worse shape in terms of the long-term solvency than the United States is. We've led the way. We've created all sorts of instruments that are now weapons of mass financial destruction. We're the experts in the field, and we're going to do everything we can to keep the system afloat. I'm talking now the Fed, the Treasury. But the rest of the world has come very close to the brink a couple of times, and it's not going to take them much to dump the dollar. And if you see a sharp decline in the dollar in its exchange rate value, you will start to see spikes in commodity prices such as oil. You'll see a tremendous spike in gold and silver. Now, I'm not a day-to-day trader in any of this stuff. And I'm not trying to be a day-to-day forecaster. But when I talk about someone buying gold or silver, number one, I'm talking about looking at the precious, the physical precious metal, holding it. Number two, I'm not looking at, buying and selling day to day and trying to make a profit on it that way. I view it as a store of wealth, safety in an extraordinary time that's still ahead of us. So that you have. What you do is you use the precious metals to preserve the purchasing value of your assets and wealth. You don't have to put all your money into it, but have enough core there to provide you with enough liquid wealth, because the precious metals do maintain liquidities, particularly if you have the physical possession, that gets you through extraordinarily difficult time. You come out on the other side, you're able to use that any way that you want to invest or whatever you're looking to do. Someone who's concerned about what's down the road here, you have to look at hard assets. Hard meaning not a paper asset that's valued in dollars. So although there are some exceptions. For example, people like gold mining stocks. I have no problems with gold mining stocks. There is a caveat here. Real estate, another hard asset. Over time, real estate's great. But when you get tremendous disruptions to the system, you may have disruptions in the markets and clearing houses. You may see liquidity issues with real estate. Those hard assets that may have short-term liquidity or portability problems are fine for holding in the long term, but you need something in the short term that is liquid and will move in terms of liquid value with the crisis at hand, and that's what gold and silver do.
And they have the added benefit, or at least investors do today, of so many different means to trade, exchange precious metals, whether it be, 90% dimes, 90% silver dimes, that is. And there's so many other mediums. There's a 1/10 and even 1/20 an ounce gold that can be purchased in eagles and pesos and other currencies, and many options available.
I publish an electronic newsletter that's weekly. The headlines and often more than once a week. The headlines you'll see in the left-hand column of our homepage, which is shadowstats.com. The newsletter is by subscription. Again, the headlines give you a sense as to what's there. Annual subscription's $175, 6 months, $89. You see links on special reports and hyperinflation reports. Gives you a general idea of the background into which I've been discussing things today, comments on the inflation reality, and also publish estimates of the unemployment rate where it is in reality, at least as the common experience. I try to reflect economic data and both in inflation, GDP, unemployment, in a way that's basically coincident with common experience. I find that Main Street USA has a much better sense of what's going on than what you get out of the government's numbers. Our alternative measures are available as well on the site. Look at the S&P 500. The companies there are broad indicators of what's happening in the economy. You look at revenues, actual sales. Down year to year, that's happened for at least three, four quarters. Down quarter to quarter. You look at industrial production, contracted the first couple of quarters of this year, flat now. It's going to be down again coming down in the fourth quarter. You don't see movements like that outside of recessions. Never happened. It's not going to happen. We're in a recession. It'll be recognized as such, and the implications of that again are horrendous. For the budget deficit, for Fed activity, for bank solvency, all this is coming to head in the near term. The signs are there. Just look for them, and I think you'll find there's good reason here for the defining authority here is the National Bureau of Economic Research. The GDP has gotten so heavily gimmicked that you don't always have two quarters. There will be two quarters. There have been two quarters. You'll see it eventually in the revision, in the revisions. But the National Bureau of Economic Research has gotten to the point that at times recessions and recognizes them based on things such as industrial production and employment, the problems with the employment numbers. But you'll see that coming in line very quickly. Retail sales. Let me put it this way. The 2007 recession, which I don't think anybody will dispute, was a pretty bad one. You might argue as to when it started, but it wasn't recognized until the end of 2008.
We are certainly seeing signs that corroborate this stance in the U.S. equities market. For instance, as you mentioned, 2007 to 2008, sideways consolidation throughout all of the U.S. equities markets caught a lot of people off guard, but we're seeing a virtually identical scenario playing out in prices and shares. If there are listeners who have picked up on your message, they can take some precautions. They could start to look into bear funds. funds, for instance, and leveraged bear funds and other methods to shield at least the equity side of their portfolios from what could be another downturn, which always follows the announcement of a recession in the United States?
Well, that may be. I'm not trying to predict the stock market and the high in inflation. Usually stocks will tend to rise with inflation. The problem is you get into the circumstance that we have here, start getting a hyperinflation, stocks could be up 90% in a couple of days, but they'll still be negative. The performance still be negative thereafter, inflation versus gold. I'm looking at a very dangerous time here again. I'd look to buy an insurance policy and hold gold.
Excellent. So, I mean, if we start to see signs where precious metals are consistently outperforming shares, at least on a domestic basis, that is time to start heading for the hills.
It's tough to pick that in advance. But again, all I'm suggesting with gold is view it as an insurance policy. And don't worry if it falls or goes up and down. You'll see that. But when it really takes off and the crisis breaks, you'll be very happy to hold it.
Excellent. Sage advice from John Williams at Shadow Stats. We're going to look forward to having you back on Gold Seek Radio, sir.
Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of Gold Seek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
Gold Seek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.